Today, on this episode of the PeerDirect Special Spotlight.
So there's been a lot going on in the metastatic space over the last 6 months with this big shift. Up until then, it was very clear what to do, up until about a year ago, okay?
Today, Drs. Isaac and Trina join the podcast to discuss 2025 San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium, Maintenance Therapy Updates in Metastatic HER2-Positive Breast Cancer, in this PeerDirect Specialist Spotlight. All opinions expressed are those of the presenters and do not necessarily reflect the views of this educational initiative's supporters.
Welcome back to the next part of our discussion from the 2025 San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium. I'm Tiffany Trina. I'm the Vice Chair of Oncology in the Department of Medicine and Section Head of the Triple Negative Breast Cancer Clinical Research Program at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York.
Hello, I'm Claudine Isaacs. I'm a Professor of Medicine and Oncology, the Associate Director of Clinical Research, the Leader of the Clinical Breast Cancer Program, and the Co-Director of the Fisher Center for Hereditary Cancer Research at the Lombardi Comprehensive Cancer Center at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C.
I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about, you know, shifting into the metastatic setting as we talk about this balance between high efficacy and minimizing toxicity for our patients.
Yeah. So there's been a lot going on in the metastatic space over the last 6 months with this big shift. Up until then, it was very clear what to do, up until about a year ago, okay? We knew first-line therapy was the Cleopatra regimen. So you were starting off with induction chemotherapy, with HER2-directed therapy with HP, and then you were doing maintenance HP. And so I think that really was our standard up until now. And what we've seen in the last number of months, there are a series of trials that have looked at, should we change that first-line approach? And that's been a pretty static space for us for the past decade or so. And what we've seen are a couple of different strategies. One of the trials that was presented, I think, was really important at San Antonio this year, was looking at that maintenance part. Could we do better during maintenance? And I just want, I think what we're going to do is just walk through just a panoply of studies that have sort of shaken up that space for us. So the HER2CLIMB-05 trial was really looking at that question in the maintenance phase with the Cleopatra. So instead of just doing HP, the question that was asked in this trial is, what if you add to catnip? So it randomly, this was a randomized trial with the Cleopatra regimens we talked about, but during the maintenance phase, patients were randomized to either get to catnip with the HP or to placebo with the HP. And they were also allowed to get endocrine therapy, but it was not mandated. And that's an important thing for us to remember. If we look at the characteristics of the patients who participated in the trial, about 50% of them had hormone receptor positive disease. Patients with asymptomatic brain metastases were permitted, and about 12% of patients who entered the trial had asymptomatic brain metastases. If you look at the breakdown between de novo disease versus recurrence, the majority of the patients, as is typical, I think, for what we see in this country primarily, about 70% of patients had de novo disease. When you look at how people are treated, I think it's really important in the trial today, looking at what to do in that first line setting, is how many patients with hormone receptor positive breast cancer got endocrine therapy. And that's actually a really interesting point. Frankly, until some of the more recent data came out, I didn't go back to Cleopatra to look, but actually in Cleopatra, endocrine therapy was not permitted. Okay. So that's why the data that we have from Cleopatra for the hormone receptor positive, HER2 positive patients didn't get endocrine therapy. But we know from more recent data that it clearly makes a big difference. So in HER2CLIMB-05, about 45% or so of patients with hormone receptor positive disease got endocrine therapy. A big chunk didn't as well. The primary endpoint was a median PFS, and it was investigator assessed. And there was an impressive benefit when the tucatinib was added on. The median PFS difference in terms of outcome, it was about an 8.6 month delta in PFS. It was going from about 25 months in the patients who got the tucatinib compared to just over 16 months in the patients who were on the placebo arm. And remember, this, what we're counting when we're looking at the PFS here, is from the time of randomization. which was after they completed their induction therapy. The benefit was seen both for patients who had hormone receptor positive and hormone receptor negative disease, although there was a greater benefit for those who had hormone receptor negative. So in the hormone receptor negative group, you were looking at 25-month median PFS versus about 12 and a half months. And in the hormone receptor positive, you were looking at that same median of 25 months in the tucatinib group versus about 18 months in the group of patients who were on the placebo. And so the deltas were a little more impressive in the hormone receptor positive. The difference between the two groups was about 7 months in terms of median PFS. And in the hormone receptor negative, HER2 positive, was a year. So, you know, these are substantial benefits. And if you looked at all of the subgroups, they all benefited from the addition of tucatinib to maintenance. There was an unplanned exploratory analysis that they looked, given our interest in reducing the risk of CNS metastases and activity in the CNS, given that this is a particularly troubling thing that we see in our patients with HER2-positive disease. There was an exploratory analysis where if they looked at the CNS PFS, so in the patients, that 12% or so of patients who came in with asymptomatic brain mets, they looked at the percent who had progression in the CNS versus not. It was about 8 months versus 4 months. So the tucatinib looked again like there was activity of the tucatinib here. If we looked at the BICR, it was very consistent with the investigator-assessed PFS. And the overall survival data were immature, but trending in the right direction. Now, obviously, one of the things that we love about maintenance HP is that it's incredibly well-tolerated, mm-hmm. right? And so the question is, what are you adding in terms of toxicity by adding the tucatinib? Now, at least the good news is it's oral. Okay, so that has some advantages. If you looked at the percent of patients who discontinued due to adverse events, it was overall quite low. Okay, it was 13% of the patients on the tucatinib arm compared to about 2% of those who were on the placebo arm. But only of those 13%, just in terms of absolute numbers, very few stopped because of diarrhea. Only 1.5% of patients overall stopped due to diarrhea, and the majority of the people who had to stop were because of AST, ALT abnormalities. There were dose modifications in about half of the patients on the tucatinib, but 35% of the patients who were on the placebo HP, and if you're looking at grade 3 toxicity or greater, it was about 42% with tucatinib versus about 24%. And then if we just drill down a little bit on diarrhea, because if we think about how that affects our patients on an everyday basis. The tucatinib did have about 70% or so of patients had any grade diarrhea, about 20% had grade 3. So obviously that's something that we need to contend with in that maintenance phase when we're really trying to give that prolonged period of excellent quality of life for our patients. But overall, it's reassuring that only about 1.5% of patients did stop because of the diarrhea. Now, within that space of maintenance, and not at this San Antonio, but at prior San Antonio, we saw the results of the PATINA trial, also trying to do better in that maintenance phase and asking really what was the role in patients who had hormone receptor positive, HER2 positive disease, just focusing on that group in the maintenance phase with CLEOPATRA, randomizing them to either getting endocrine therapy, obviously continuing the HER2-directed therapy, endocrine therapy alone or endocrine therapy plus palbociclib. And I think there were a couple of messages from that for me, and we're not going to go into this in detail because that's old news for us, sort of. These days, news travels so quickly, it's hard. Anything that's more than a few months old is sort of old news. But what we saw was, I think for me, one of the biggest things was, how important it is for us to make sure that our patients with hormone receptor positive, HER2 positive, are getting endocrine therapy.
That's right.
And what they saw was looking at the median PFS for the patients who got endocrine therapy was 29 months. So obviously a whole lot better than what we saw with CLEOPATRA. Okay. And then if you looked at the patients when they added the palbociclib to this, it went to 44 months. I mean, that was a huge delta. And I think without question, this is something we really need to be thinking about in our patients with hormone receptor positive, HER2 positive disease.
Dare I ask how you reconcile both of those maintenance strategies? Having looked at some of the unplanned subsets, perhaps, is there a way, if we had both of these available to us, which we don't at the moment, we're still waiting on that even from PATINA, but we have maintenance strategies now both for tucatinib and for palbociclib. certainly not the combination of those data. We don't have the combination of those agents together. So is there a way that you would stratify who gets what?
You know, obviously it's easy to say that the easiest answer here, as you know, is that in the hormone receptor negative, we don't have the option of the patina data. So that's easier.
That's right.
So certainly, I think in a patient like that, we might think about the Duchenne. Mm-hmm. And obviously, the last trial that we need to talk about that we'll come to is like, you know, how do we blow this all up if we think about the DB09 data looking at TDXD as the initial treatment? And we'll talk about that in a moment. But let's just focus on maintenance then. I think in the hormone receptor positive, you know, I think it's important to remember that in the HER2CLIMB trial, endocrine therapy wasn't mandated, and under half of the patients got endocrine therapy as well. So you might see better results if they'd gotten the endocrine therapy plus the Ducatinib universally. But maybe if you have a patient who has more issues in terms of brain metastases at mm-hmm. the diagnosis, maybe that would be something you'd be thinking of. I don't know how to reconcile this. You know, certainly I think that probably my sense is that palbociclib is probably a little bit better tolerated. Mm-hmm. But I think maybe, you know, it's going to be an individualized discussion with our patients. And again, we have to throw in the wild card of, you know, maybe we shouldn't be doing Cleopatra, and then we're not even thinking about any of this. Please join us for the next part of our discussion from the 2025 San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium.
And that's today's Specialist Spotlight. Thank you for joining us for this episode of PeerDirect Medical News Podcast. For more stories like these, visit us at peerdirect.com. Thoughts, comments, or suggestions? Please leave us a review in your preferred listening platform or email us at editorial@peerdirect.com. Listen and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also download our Amazon Alexa Flash Briefing Medical News Roundup and just ask, what's my flash briefing? Thanks today to our guests, Drs. Isaacs and Trana. Join me next time for the episode where we'll cover the latest stories in the world of medicine.